Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Rest is History bonus episode. And Dominic, we are up bright and early on Monday morning, and I have hauled you out of bed very early because I'm off to the library today.
Yes, Tom, this is unprecedented to be recording so early, I think. Why are you? What's the story? What are you going to the library for? Surely you have. I mean, I see your study every week, and you have, you know, the most. Tom has the most amazing study for those people who haven't seen it. So you have kind of towering bookshelves going right up to the ceiling, don't you?
I do.
So I can't believe there is anything you don't have.
No, there's plenty I don't have. So I'm halfway through my new book, which is on the heyday of the Roman Empire, and it's ironically called Pax, not entirely ironically. So Pax is Latin for peace, the Pax Romana, and it's divided into two halves. War and peace. Right. And I've just finished the war section. So that includes the year of the four emperors, AD 69, mm-hmm. the Judean war, so the sacking of Jerusalem, destruction of the temple, all that. And I've ended it with the death of Vespasian. But now I'm into the proper Pax, the kind of the peace section, yeah. And I have to do Pompeii. So Vespasian dies in the summer of AD 79. And Pompeii is destroyed either in the summer or the autumn of AD 79. It's debated. So I need to go and have a look. I'm actually, at the moment, I'm going through the entire works of Pliny the Elder.
Okay.
You know, he wrote this fabulous encyclopedia. I mean, he's always kind of popping up. So he's the guy who says that hedgehogs roll around and pick up grapes on their spine, all that kind of stuff. And it's full of wonderful, wonderful. And I've just read a segment where he is talking about how fire comes up out of the earth. So he's including volcanoes in that. But, you know, he doesn't include Vesuvius because he
irony.
Doesn't know. He doesn't know that Vesuvius is a volcano. Although,
right.
Of course, he will. He will come to find that out.
So hold on, why are you going to the library? Surely you can, the elder, you can read him online.
Because there's a fabulous classics library that has entire shelves on Pliny the Elder. So I'm just going to kind of munch my way through all the books.
Fair enough.
Caterpillar going through a lettuce leaf.
Fair enough. Do you know what I'm doing today?
What are you doing today, Dominic?
I am finishing a chapter of my children's book about the Vikings.
Oh, are you?
On the gods, a chapter on the gods. And then I'm giving a lecture to King Edward's Birmingham about the top 10 prime ministers in all history.
Oh, wonderful. Is it just British ones or
just British.
Prime ministers around the world?
No, just British. Otherwise, prime ministers around the world would open up all kinds of
strange candidates. It would open up a can of worms, wouldn't it?
It would do. Do you know who my number one is?
Clement Attlee.
No.
He's been voted for, but he's the people's choice, Dominic.
No, I defy that.
Oh.
I actually change my views quite often, but my number one in
Stanley
this
Baldwin.
Lecture, so I'll have given the lecture by the time, is Robert Walpole.
Oh, controversial.
Well,
because
he's the
founder.
He's the
Augustus.
He's also the longest surviving.
And he ends up with the best house, doesn't he?
He does.
He ends up with a huge house,
Tom,
in Norfolk.
A fantastic house. But also, Tom, he is presiding over a new nation, as we shall be discovering in our podcast with Colin Kidd about the Union. So to be steering the ship of state when the nation is mm-hmm. young is quite a big deal. But also it's a period of colossal, it's industrial revolution, it's rise to greatness, all that kind of stuff. Just because he's a bit corrupt.
War of Jenkins' Ear.
Well, that kind of brings him down, actually. War of Jenkins' Ear, that comes right at the end of his tenure. But yeah, so I shall look forward to that.
Okay, so can you just give us your top 10? Because in the hope that this will be going out after you've given the talk, so no one's going to get
spoil
the
excitement. I'm actually going to have to remind myself. Top 10 prime ministers.
Is Tony in it?
No. So number 10, Benjamin Disraeli.
Oh, low. I'd have thought he'd be higher.
Number 9 is Stanley Baldwin.
Okay.
Number 8, Robert Peel. Number 7 is Asquith. Number 6 is Attlee. Number 5 is Thatcher. Number 4 is Pitt the Younger. Number 3 is Gladstone. Number 2 is Churchill. And number 1 is Walpole.
So no place for Boris.
No Boris and no Lloyd George. Lloyd George is the one that, when I've given that talk before, people say, what about David Lloyd George? They say it in a Welsh voice. They say, I'm not going to do my Welsh accent.
Well, they say reverse a top speed out of that particular class.
Well, they say it in a Liberal Democrat's voice. about Lloyd George? And I have no time for him, so he doesn't get in the top 10.
Okay, well, you're going to have a more exciting day than me then. Well, no, actually, I'm going to have an exciting day. I'm really looking forward to it.
Good. Well, that's good.
Yeah. Anyway, so here we are. So, Dominic.
I think we should discuss Russia.
Russia, the Russian episode.
So we've just, you'll be listening to this, I imagine, in the middle of, or having already listened to, series about Russia, which we actually recorded, Tom. We should be completely open since, you know, these are the members. So we basically had it in mind, I think, initially to record it as one episode, and then it became two episodes. And then the producers said, let's split it in the two into four, because that'll be more accessible to the general public.
Because this is like the kind of Pompidou Center of podcasting, isn't it? We're putting all the workings on the outside.
Yeah, so I think it's interesting for people to know the workings, actually, for the members to know the workings, because they've listened to us long enough. So they probably have a suspicion of how it works.
People will have heard the opening of the first episode, which features George Bush talking about Vladimir Putin at his ranch. And the massive topic of debate was whether because you from the beginning you said we should put in the actual footage.
I thought we could just use Bush himself.
I was very keen to do an impression.
You were. I was. Are you feeling cheated, Tom?
No, I'm not, because I think there's a kind of rawness around the whole subject, isn't there?
Yeah,
that there is. It's not a place actually for levity, really, or for jokes, or for any of the, and it kind of brings home how you know, the stuff of history is so often brutal, you know, terrible. It involves suffering and death and war, but if it happens, you know, several centuries ago, then you can, you know, it's becomes the stuff of humor. But if it's raw and you know, contemporary, then it's not.
It's so interesting that, Tom, that's come up a few times on the Discord. And actually, we've talked about that at home sometimes, like with my son, about the way that, you know, so right at the beginning, we were talking about what we're doing. I'm writing a kid's book about the Vikings. Now, basically, every paragraph, it's kind of a horde of men burst into a monastery with a load of axes. This is not a brooches and beads history of the Vikings by any means. This is a sort of slaughter and blood history of the Vikings. And in that, you know, there's no sense at all, I think, for anybody who works on that kind of material, particularly in the way it's, because almost all children in Britain study the Vikings, because it's such an attractive subject, and they love it. You go to Jorvik in York, the Viking centre, or indeed you go to any Viking site in Scandinavia, and the gift shop is full of axes and helmets and books that glory in the violence. And actually,
that's true, but Jorvik itself is quite peaceful.
Yeah,
traders.
Look,
here's one of their poos.
Yeah, it is. It is.
It has the largest fossilized stool, doesn't it?
It does indeed. It does indeed. Yeah. And it has a recreation of Viking smells, doesn't it, when you go around it? So there's that you get in these little sort of buggies that take you around the recreation of the town, and they have all the smells. That's all true. But then you get upstairs to the shop and it's all basically swords. Yeah. And writing about it in the last week or so, I kept thinking how weird it is to be writing about this and obviously kind of slightly, frankly, wallowing in it, as all kids' books on the Vikings do, when at the same time I'm constantly refreshing the news, and the news is of the most horrific kind of bloodshed and tragedy, which is obviously would have been true in the 9th century. But there is a kind of weird statute of limitations. Do you not think, where our empathy kind of deserts us, and where we turn conflict into entertainment? And a lot of people are, I mean, am I uneasy about it? I'm aware of it, but I kind of have slightly having my cake and eating, I suppose. So pretending to care about it, but at the same time monetizing it in my kid's book. I mean, I'm being too cynical, but you know what I mean? You do that. I mean,
I know
that.
Exactly.
You do that
what
in your Roman books.
I know exactly what you mean, because, you know, I was the kind of child who was obsessed by Vikings and Romans. And I mean, that's why I ended up writing about the Romans. And my sense of Julius Caesar was basically the Caesar of Asterix, that he conquers Gaul and nobody dies.
Yeah.
You know, they just end up in a tree, perhaps, with a few stars going around your head. and essentially, the process by which I came from writing about the Romans to writing about Christianity was actually thinking, this is awful. This is terrifying. And why do I think it's terrifying? Why do I find it's terrifying in a way that the Romans clearly didn't?
That's your Christianity thing, isn't it?
And that's the Christianity thing. So it has been a kind of process of adjustment to that. I do find the whole thing very, very interesting. And actually writing about the siege of Jerusalem, the sack of Jerusalem, I mean, it's, you know, it's not been an enjoyable thing to write. It's been kind of, I mean, it's horrendous, absolutely horrendous.
Anyway, you know,
with Ukraine in the background. Anyway, yes.
Was whether you're going to do a depression of George W. Bush.
Yes, right. Right, right. So we decided not. Simply because it's...
Yeah, it would be weird. It would have set the episode off on the wrong note, I think.
And it's quite a dark story, you know, not just for Ukrainians, is it, but for Russians as well.
Right, it is. Yeah, it is. It's a story of... It's funny, actually, because one of the things my son had at Christmas, or I was given at Christmas, but he loves it, is the Private Eye Annual for last year. Mm-hmm. He understands about 10% of 20% of the jokes.
So we should explain that for people who aren't British, that it's a kind of satirical magazine. It comes out fortnightly about British politics. And I think if you're in any way interested in politics and you're British, it's a kind of gateway drug to understanding how politics
works. It is, exactly.
Because you have to work out who the characters are.
Yeah. So Arthur loves it. He likes all the jokes about Boris and stuff. But he said to me, gosh, there are a lot of jokes here about Vladimir Putin. And you wouldn't be able to do them today because, of course, he's Hitler now. And he was telling me how at school, you know, all the 10-year-olds say, he's Hitler, all this stuff. This is all, they're all excited and discussing where they're going to hide in the event of a nuclear war and stuff in the way that 10-year-olds, 10-year-old right. boys do. And I sort of thought, it is, you know, we did that, our very first podcast on the subject of greatness. And in that podcast, we ended by saying, is there anybody who will be regarded as great? And we talked about Vladimir Putin, certainly his sense of himself as great, and Russians, you know, he has, we talked about that sense of greatness that's born of martial prowess, glory, conquest, strength, you know, the projection of the kind of image mm-hmm. of virility that Alexander had and Pompey had and all these, yeah, I don't know, Henry VIII or Napoleon or whatever. And we talked about Putin, but of course, that's not a conversation we'd have in the same way today. Do you think, Tom?
No, we wouldn't. Even though what he's doing to the cities in Ukraine is what he'd already done in Syria in Chechnya. And
what commanders have done in history in a way that people pass off in a footnote. Oh, by the way, he leveled this city, he smashed up Corinth, he destroyed Thebes. And we sort of say, oh, ha, 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 you know, that was another sign of his greatness. But actually, when you read that against the news, it makes you think a bit more deeply about the consequences.
I think you're being harsh on us as a collective, because I think we did push at the kind of paradoxes there and the moral complexities of the idea of greatness. When the war began, I put out a tweet where I said kind of Vladimir Putin, Peter the Great, or Anthony Eden.
Oh, yeah, I saw that. Yeah. People didn't like that.
Some people were very, very upset by that.
Yeah.
I suppose... I wasn't quite sure why they were upset. I suppose the implication that Putin could in any way be great. But obviously, you know, Peter the Great was great because he built Russia in the case of St. Petersburg, literally on the backs of the bones of those who built this extraordinary city out of kind of the mud flats of the north. But I mean, he killed a lot of people. And
yes.
Peter the Great, like Stalin, is one of the two great heroes of Putin. And that is a kind of model of greatness that he's consciously aspiring to.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, or will he turn out to be Anthony Eden, i.e. will he be brought down by sanctions?
Well, I mean, I think it's fair to say that we're hopeful, aren't we? But the extraordinary thing is that I'm still kind of struggling to get a sense of is the extent to which Russia in the last few days has been cut off behind a renewed Iron Curtain. You know, none of these media organizations now working in Russia, so we're not getting the same information we were once getting. Twitter banned in Russia, so, you know, we're not getting the same flow of social media. And this possibility that actually in the next few months, things will happen in cities in Russia, and we'll just hear garbled reports of them as we would have once done in the 1980s and actually not know what's happening.
People are posting restaurant reviews, aren't they? Have you seen that?
Yes, I have. Google Maps reviews to try and get messages across to Russians. You're being lied.
But also vice versa.
Oh, are they posting reviews?
Yes, I think so.
Tea rooms and Stow on the Wold.
Yes. Help, we're being attacked kind of thing.
Oh, all right. Golly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure that'll be clear. I mean, if we're talking about it on a podcast, I'm sure the Russian security services are onto that.
Do you reckon they're listening to this podcast?
I doubt it. I very much doubt it. Anyway, all very depressing.
But the story that we told in those four episodes, so I now wish, you know, I wanted to do that subject for ages, and I slightly wish we'd done it in even more depth. Because particularly, I think, Russia in the 90s, it was such a crazy period. And
the Wild East.
It was absolutely the Wild East. There were so many. I mean, Dominic Cummings, Boris Johnson's erstwhile advisor, now fiercest critic, sort of the brains of Brexit, he was in Russia in the 1990s, I think, trying to develop an airline. Isn't that right?
He was about 10, wasn't he?
Yeah. I think he just left university and went straight to Russia in that way that some people did. And some people obviously became incredibly rich. But the combination of that, of the looting and the oligarchs, with the utter collapse in living standards, the poverty, but also the insane politics. So another thing we didn't massively touch on was the fact that we talked about it as Weimar, but the political scene in Russia was so extreme, and there was so much anti-Semitism, for example, and fervent kind of nationalism. And one of the really remarkable things is that in the 90s. All these different political forces kind of coalesced behind this, what you could call a kind of red-brown, you know, communist-stroke-fascist coalescence. I've used coalesce twice, but there you go. So I was only just seeing yesterday the head of the Communist Party, who we mentioned in the podcast, Gennady Zyuganov. He came second to Yeltsin in 1996. He gave a press conference yesterday, saying that NATO and the Americans have established biological weapons labs in Georgia, Kazakhstan, and Ukraine, just over the border. And they're preparing their biological and chemical weapons to attack the Russian people. And that's why, you know, Putin should go further and go faster, kind of thing. And I thought, how...
But at least he hasn't said put them in the Baltic republics, which would be...
No, I suppose that would be terrifying.
So Dominic, I mean, I'm aware that we're now getting straying into politics and we're...
We don't want to do a Rory Stewart and Alistair Campbell, do we?
We don't. But just because you know much more about this than me, the end game. I mean, is there any conceivable end game
that you can see?
Because, I mean, it's obviously gone terribly wrong for Putin. The war's gone badly.
Yeah.
The economy has been hit much worse than he'd anticipated. The only way that he can really row back is to kind of say, I got it wrong. And he's never going to do that.
He's not going to do that, no.
So the only option really seems to be to escalate it, isn't it? And to try and get in a kind of fight with NATO.
I mean, that's a very, very grim way of putting it. I think so my reading of it is this, that Putin, like so many people, ended up believing his own propaganda, just being surrounded by people who told him what he wanted to hear, that the West was weak, that Ukraine was basically a complete shambles and a Frankenstein's monster of a country.
And do you think he really thought that they were a bunch of Nazis? I mean, he's literally saying about a state led by a Jewish president.
I mean, that's crazy, that they're Nazis. Isn't it? I think there's a bit of him. It's impossible to say, isn't it? Did Hitler believe all the mad things that Hitler...
Yes, I think he did, didn't he?
I suppose he did. Did Stalin?
Yes.
You end up believing it yourself, don't you? I mean, this is the thing with politicians. You end up... Part of you knows that some of it is contrived, exaggerated, all of that stuff. But you end up convincing yourself, especially if you're in an echo chamber where other people just articulate your prejudices to you.
Or is it an illustration of my thesis that Hitler has become the devil, and that your enemies, if you're in a kind of Manichaean, good and evil, light and dark, your enemies have to be Nazis because that's the only possible justification.
That's absolutely true in Russia, because what's happened in Russia in the last 20 years is the Second World War. I mean, God, think how much we beat ourselves up in Britain about this. The Second World War has become a stifling kind of national myth. So everything is seen through that prism. And in a way, they now... even if there's no evidence of Nazism whatsoever. I mean, by the way, there are far-right extremists in Ukraine, but they are such a minority on the political spectrum. They don't even hold, I think, any seats in the Ukrainian parliament.
No, and to repeat...
Zelensky is Jewish.
Their president is Jewish. I mean,
their president is a Russian speaker and is Jewish. Exactly, Tom.
And so that part of the kind of the paradoxical horror of what's happening is that the Russians are... they've become their worst nightmares. So they are, you know, they're making Stalingrads out of Ukrainian cities in which they are playing the part of the Germans.
They are indeed.
And they're laying siege to Kyiv as the Mongols laid siege to it.
Well, and
so they're playing the part of the Mongols.
Yeah, agreed.
So, I mean, it's a terrible situation.
Anyway, you asked about the end game. Sorry, Tom, I rambled and didn't answer. You asked about the end game. Putin is now in a position where, when he wakes up in the morning and thinks about his options, continuing fighting is probably his least worst option as he sees it. He can't stop and say it was all a mistake. He can't really declare victory and go home, I don't think. there's almost no way back for him now with the West. It's hard to see, you know, it's not like he can say, sorry, I've made a mistake and people will relax the sanctions. I mean, that's not really how it works. I think he thinks I will just power through. He perhaps thinks if there's a change of administration in America, you know, if the West will lose interest, people get bored, I'll present them with a fait accompli. I mean, he's no stranger to frozen conflicts as well. So Georgia, Transnistria, places like that, where basically the Russians are still there, but it's just sort of, there's just a stalemate in these places. So perhaps he thinks, I'll just keep fighting, it'll end up being a stalemate in Ukraine forever and ever, and eventually I'll get what I want because they'll lose interest and all this stuff. I mean, the problem he'll have is losses of troops. You know,
and
losses
of money.
So expensive, losses of money. Yeah, you're right. I mean, the trouble is a lot of young Russians have been connected, haven't they, to the sort of world network. I mean, just even small things like they're not going to get Netflix. They're not going to get the new cinema releases. They're not going to get Apple products. They're not going to get all these things. And of course, these are all kind of middle-class things. But often the middle class is the very people who drive revolutions and regime changes. How long will they tolerate that for? Who knows?
But just to repeat, if you're faced with escalating military losses.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, lorries that are just endlessly being blown up. So, I mean, it's possible to see that you might even be facing kind of military, you know, maybe not defeat, but stalemate.
Yeah. And stalemate is a defeat for him, really, I think.
Yeah. And economic kind of oblivion. What do you do in that situation? I mean, you busy getting mines with foreign corals. You escalate it.
Yeah, but what for? I mean, this is like that. People have often described Putin as a chess player. I think I've probably done it myself and regret it now because I think it's better to see him as a gambler. There is a point when you're playing chess, though.
Poker player.
There's a point when you're playing chess, Tom, when everything's going, you know, to pot and you're losing. You know, it's perfectly obvious your opponent has taken more
pieces. So you shoot your opponent.
Yeah, well, you just sort of...
Whip a gun out and shoot him.
You just think, sod it, I'll just attack wildly and see who cares. And you can get into that mood where you just think, I'll try anything. But if he thinks one stage beyond that, let's say he does stage a provocation in the borders of the Baltic states. Again, what's his end game? Where's he hoping to get to? Because, I mean, it's not like... I know the Russians boast that they have more nuclear weapons than NATO, but NATO have more than enough nuclear weapons to destroy Russia, as the Russians do the West. So what's the point?
But without Russia, why should the world survive? That's what he said.
But is he going to kill himself in order to...
But it's kind of like suicide by cop, isn't it? It's kind of suicide by NATO.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know, Dominic. I have no idea.
I mean, if, you know, your Hitler parallel or the Hitler parallel that is so common and appears to be the sort of school playground parallel.
Well, and we put it in ours, didn't we?
There was definitely a point.
Yeah. In the podcast.
There was a point in early 1945 when Hitler says to his the people around him, you know, Germany has failed. Everything will go down. It must go down in flames. The Germans don't deserve to live. All this. I don't think Putin will say that because he's not as histrionic as Hitler.
He is in cahoots with the Wagner group.
They're terrifying, aren't they? How is a group like that allowed to even exist?
Gotterdammerung.
They're kind of mercenaries. Yeah.
And that kind of Wagnerian sense of the death of the gods.
Yeah, but
that was part of... I don't know, Dominic. I don't know enough about him. I mean, he's a riddle wrapped in an enigma, wrapped in a mystery.
I think an interesting thing that's a clue to his character that I think makes him different from, let's say, Hitler. I mean, that's such a hackneyed comparison, I know, but Putin has squirreled away billions of pounds in a Swiss bank account, which suggests that...
Which presumably now he can't get.
No, exactly, but also it suggests that he envisaged at some stage a future for himself in which he would spend this money, otherwise there's no point in having it.
So I don't think he's Hitler in the sense that he... I mean, Hitler, I think, really did believe all the stuff about
there was a kind of
competition
mad...
between the races, and that if the Aryan race, you know, the Nordic race, are not worthy of him, then they deserve to perish. I mean, I do think he believed that. Putin is obviously a kind of a chill kleptocrat, basically.
Yeah.
But he's also a guy who I would guess who can't stand to look ridiculous. And for Putin, I mean, it's Zelensky's kind of his worst nightmare, right? Because for Putin, Zelensky seems like, you know, he's this Jewish kind of ladyboy figure. He's playing piano with his penis. He's everything that Putin kind of hates.
You don't think that of him though, Tom, surely?
No, of course not. But for Putin...
Just to be clear, in case...
Yeah, of course. But for Putin, the fact that Zelensky is, you know, he's kind of part of the... the kind of Weimar type world, to put it that way.
I mean, Putin sees him as the, we'll see him as the personification of decadence, won't he?
Yeah, he sees him as decadent, that we wouldn't. I think.
I mean, we look at Zelensky and we see a hero, but Putin doesn't.
Well, I think probably Putin does now see him. I mean, probably Putin is getting a grudging respect for him. But the fact that Zelensky has kind of proved Putin wrong, you know, that he's actually turned out not to be this effete, decadent embodiment of everything that Putin despises, and actually, you know, is he's become a kind of a totem of heroism in a way that Putin never has. I mean, in a way, he's kind of become the figure that Putin might want to be.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think that would make Putin regard him any more favorably. Just the worse, really. And so, faced by that, the humiliation of it. You know, and I'm doing absolutely cod psychology here, but I can see him. You know, you back someone like that into a corner.
I know
he doesn't just kind of go, "Okay, guys, sorry."
Yeah, I mean, this is why I think a lot of people are desperate to see some sort of regime change, because I think if we are going to be really depressing about it, I think if you push him in a corner, the most likely thing he could conceivably do is use some kind of nuclear weapon in Ukraine. So, and then he would claim, you know, they were building a nuclear bomb in Kyiv and it went off. I think that's perfectly plausible. He would argue that.
Or and chemicals.
Chemical. I think that's that's terrifying. I think his argument now, if his men are sitting around him, Shoigu and the commanders and whatever, he would be saying to them, Russia cannot afford to lose this. If Russia loses this war, our days of great powerdom are gone.
So he will be Anthony Eden.
The stakes are higher than ever. Yeah, I mean, why did the Americans keep throwing troops into Vietnam? Because they said once we're there, the blow to our credibility if we lose will be so great. So they just kept doing it. So that's the fear, isn't it? Sorry, this has become so depressing. The bonus is meant to be jolly.
Yes, it is. Do we have any jolly questions?
So somebody, Tom, is very depressed. This is another depressing subject, but one I know you will have something to say about. And it's a part of the world we haven't discussed. We did one podcast night, but we haven't discussed it very much in the course of the rest of history, and that is Australia. And Joan of Arc says he's been absolutely floored by the death of Shane Warne, the Australian bowler. So, Tom, tell us, for those people who, like American members who don't follow cricket, why is Shane Warne such a huge character in the kind of Anglo-Australian imagination?
So Shane Warne died in Thailand. For reasons that as yet are not entirely clear. He was the most charismatic and the most skillful bowler of all time. And the bowler in cricket is the equivalent of the pitcher in baseball. And a cricket ball has a seam on it. And if you're a spin bowler, you rotate it, you spin it. And if you're particularly skillful, you can make the ball do extraordinary things. And Shane Warne could make the ball sing and talk to a more remarkable degree than any bowler probably who's ever played the game. And on top of that, he was just an extraordinary figure. He kind of loved sausage rolls. I think he kind of, certainly for the English and maybe for the Australians too, he summed up a kind of an ideal of what an Australian lad is like. Absolutely.
I love, Tom, that your first thing you think of to describe someone as an extraordinary character is that I like sausage rolls. I mean, I like sausage rolls.
but if you're one of the greatest sportsmen, one of the greatest athletes of all time.
He was a smoker wasn't he?
He was a smoker, yeah.
He was a drinker. He went out with Liz Hurley.
Liz Hurley, who also went out with Hugh Grant, who was in Austin Powers. So he was absolutely kind of sporting A-class. And Wisden, which is the kind of the Bible of cricket, at the end of the 20th century, they got cricket writers from around the world. So I think 100 of them to nominate the greatest cricketers of the 20th century. And Shane Warne was in the middle of his playing career and he was one of the five. So he was the only one who was still playing. And also he's 52, so he was a young guy. He was a young man.
His fame is not just the cricketing, though, is it? He's a bit like Maradona, I would say.
Yes, he's absolutely Maradona. Although not as tragic. I mean, one of the reasons why he may have died is that he went on a 15-day binge diet.
Yeah, he did. Just drinks, no food at all. Yeah. Is that right?
Yeah. He posted a picture of himself on Instagram looking very kind of beefy and honed. And he said, I want to get back to this.
Yeah.
So it was.
But it was his persona, I think. I think in an age when he played and then he commentated at a time when there was a lot of sort of angst about masculinity and all this kind of business. And he absolutely, like Ian Botham, his sort of predecessor a generation earlier, he absolutely incarnated a kind of completely self-confident manliness, old-fashioned manliness, didn't he, Warne? He was like a man's man, but the girls loved him. He was absolutely sort of shameless in his hedonism, in his ebullience, in his sort of larkiness, I suppose.
He's a larrikin.
A larrikin, exactly. That's what larrikin. He's a larrikin. He was just so incredibly Australian. I think that's the...
Well, he was a kind of... he was a Neighbours kind of Australian. A Neighbours, like, you know, which is this sitcom, soap opera that's been going for years and years and years, formative, you know, absolutely kind of woven into the English sense of what Australia is like. And it was full of kind of beach blonde...
Yeah. Sort of jolly, irreverent.
Irreverent, yeah. Kind of incredibly appealing, I think, to English people.
He's the kind of man who would go into your gentleman's club, Tom, in a suit, but a pair of trainers, isn't he?
Yeah, and it would be a bright white suit.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. No, and he would swagger in as though he owned the place.
Which he probably did.
Yeah.
He was a remarkable figure and will be much missed. And it felt very like an obituary of him, actually. There's a film about him that came out on Amazon at the end of last year, which we watched the day he died. And he's talking about the balance of sport and family.
Yeah.
So he's talking about what it took to be a great cricketer as opposed to a great family man. And he said, you know, I love my family, but got to be cricket every time.
Right. God.
Absolutely. And I looked at my wife and said, that's where I've gone wrong.
Yeah. Oh.
You held me back.
That's a brilliant story. That's a perfectly calibrated bit of self-congratulation on your part, isn't it?
So subtly done.
Because you're both congratulating yourself on being such a kind, uxorious, paternal family man, but also
implying I could have been.
Exactly.
I could have been a contender.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I like to think that I've balanced them both.
Right,
But having said that, they had his three children on who were adorable and obviously adored him.
Yeah.
And actually, it was kind of very touching.
He would be a very, he'd be a dad who would be, I mean, as a dad,
he was obviously a great dad.
Yeah. You'd get up to a lot of mischief, wouldn't you?
You would, yeah.
R.I.P. Shane Warne. So what do we got coming up? We have the quiz for the Athelstan members. That's coming up, isn't it? On Sunday and Monday.
So this coming Sunday and this Monday. So if you're an Athelstan, that is something to look forward to. We've got Genghis Khan coming up with Ali Ansari.
Genghis Khan, St. Patrick's Day.
Chinggis Khan.
Well, as you know, Tom, I reviewed a book last year. What was it called? I can't remember what it was called.
Was it The Horde?
No, it was a book by a man called Otto English, who's a Twitter personality.
Oh, yes, I remember it. Yes, I think probably your greatest piece of writing.
I was not very impressed with it. It was a book saying that history was all lies and people had been fooled, and it chose 10 lies. And one of them was something to do with Genghis Khan. I can't even remember what the lie was. But throughout the chapter, having set out his stall and said that people had got completely the wrong impression about the Mongols, about Genghis Khan, he called Genghis Khan Khan throughout. So that was his...
Like Star Trek,
the Wrath of Khan. Exactly. And so that was his surname. And as I pointed out, that's a bit like somebody writing a book about Wilhelm II and calling him Kaiser, thinking it was his name.
Yeah. Oi, Kaiser, eat your deck shoes.
Yeah, exactly.
Get them off.
Brilliant. So we missed out on George W. Bush, but we did get a taxi driver insulting the Kaiser at Cowes, which was nice from you, Tom.
Yes. We've got St. Patrick, haven't we? We've got St. Patrick's Day special.
Yeah, we have indeed.
Which is such an interesting topic. I can't wait to do that. We're doing that tomorrow.
I hope you've got a lot to say, Tom, because I think I've got so much to say. That's good, because I've got about 40 seconds worth of material.
It's really interesting, though. It's the essence of history.
Well, some Irish people are quite conflicted about St. Patrick's Day, you know, because they think it's a bit of an invention, a bit of a hallmark holiday, and that it sort of presents an image of the sort of, you know, how people kind of put on ridiculous ginger wigs and stuff like that. They find that a bit patronising.
I can see that. I can see that, but it's a fascinating topic.
Okay.
It really is.
Does it have snakes? Are you going to be talking about
snakes? Yes, it does have snakes. It does have snakes. Yep.
Jolly good. Yeah. So we have that to look forward to. And that will take our minds hopefully off the news, which let's hope that improves. And I think that's it, isn't it, Tom? So
I think that is.
On that bombshell, we will let you get back on with your week and we will see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.